This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program is homecrafted and was recorded on October 14th. Thanks to everyone who donated to Co-op's Fall Membership Drive. In case you missed it, it's never too late to go to koop.org and hit the donate button. Wolverine Watchmen conspire to kidnap the governor of Michigan. A growing number of followers of QAnon claim that the world is being run by a cabal of Satan-worshipping pedophiles that operate a child sex trafficking ring. A Supreme Court nominee is a handmaiden in a Catholic charismatic cult that speaks in tongues and lives for miracles and prophecies. All this under the approving eyes of the most powerful man in the free world, whose response to the COVID-19 pandemic is to infect unwitting members of his inner circle. Philadelphia Inquirer columnist Will Bunch commented, "Normally you'd expect the end times to be a bad omen for a president seeking re-election, but not in these end times, because millions of Americans have lost their collective mind." Last month in Time magazine, Charlotte Alter reported on dozens of interviews that she conducted in Wisconsin. About 1 in 5 volunteered ideas that she considered in the realm of conspiracy theory. It's a good read, but I'll skip to her conclusion. The rise in conspiratorial thinking is the product of several interrelated trends: declining trust in institutions, demise of local news, a social media environment that makes rumor easy to spread and difficult to debunk, and a president who latches on to anything and anyone he thinks will help his political fortunes. It's also a part of our wiring. The brain likes crazy, says a noted researcher in media policy. Because of this, experts say, algorithms on platforms like Facebook and YouTube are designed to serve up content that reinforces existing beliefs. Learning what users search for and feeding them more and more extreme content in an attempt to keep them on their sites. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is Lauren Magahi, an investigative reporter for the Dallas Morning News based here in Austin. And we have our regular commentator, Jim Harrington, retired founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project. Michelle Manning Scott is away working for the Travis County Clerk through Election Day. If you're hand delivering a mail-in ballot, there's a good chance you'll meet her there at 5501 Airport Boulevard. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs, Lauren. How you been?
Thanks for having me back. Man, it feels like there's been multiple years stuffed into the year it's been since I was last on the show, doesn't it? I mean, maybe the last week feels like a year, so I'm good. I'm very, very busy and somehow working longer hours than I've ever worked. You know, I'm not going to the office regularly, so it's been a jarring few months, as I know it's been for everybody.
Yeah. The rule of thumb seems to be that we're working twice as long to do half as much, you know?
It feels like that sometimes. Yeah, for sure.
I was just digging back into the internet. Some of the stuff you've been writing about, it's like a Niagara Falls of topics. I don't even know where to begin. Maybe we could start off with one of your big stories from 2017 that just seems to keep giving, and that's the Sutherland Springs Massacre. There's actually been a few developments in that in the past several months. Could you bring us up to date on that?
Sure. If listeners don't remember, Sutherland Springs was the mass shooting down about an hour south of Austin at a church in a very, very small unincorporated area. 26 people were killed, including a pregnant woman. And the perpetrator of the shooting was a veteran who ostensibly went there looking for his mother-in-law or members of his wife's family. He had actually bound her, his wife, and left her that morning and went off to commit this horrible act. And, you know, it really threw that whole part of Texas into turmoil for a long time, not just because they lost a large part of their community, being a very small community, but because only having probably less than 1,000 people living in this small town, they were then inundated by the media and pundits and everyone who were coming to cover this horrible act, and kind of suffered a kind of a secondary trauma because of all of us descending on them like locusts. So I was there for a few days, you know, in early November when the shooting first happened. I left, and then I ended up coming back at the request of some of the townspeople who wanted me to do take a more personal look at some of their family members who were killed in the shooting. And it was, you know, frankly, became a very personal story for me over time, just spending so much time down there with people who lost family members, friends, and knowing that, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the shooting, that I and other members of the media did not help the situation. In fact, we added to the burden that we were putting on these people that were trying to grieve and understand in some way what happened to their town. So it's kind of hard to imagine that it's been almost 3 years since that happened. But there have been some developments. There's a number of court cases that are ongoing where families of the victims have actually sued both the federal government and the sporting goods store where the shooter got his gun. And both of those lawsuits are still ongoing, which is pretty incredible. Lawsuits like that after mass shootings usually don't move forward. But the one that the family members have filed against the federal government is really the interesting one in my view, because they're suing the feds for neglect, basically for being negligent, because the Air Force did not report the shooter's history of domestic violence and mental health issues to the NICS database that would have pinged him when he was trying to buy the gun. And that was one of the reasons why it was so easy for him to get the firearm that he then used in the shooting. So the fact that these families have been able to sue the federal government is almost unprecedented. And they are continuing with that lawsuit. They're actually getting documents and information from the federal government, from the Air Force. And this might be one of the first times that we ever see family members of shooting victims actually get both information from the government and potentially money because their family members were killed in a mass shooting. So pretty remarkable case. It's become a remarkable legal case, even beyond the fact that it was such a horrendous event that, you know, the numbers were, you know, astonishing just on their face. So that's where we are now with that. And we're all watching the courts.
Lauren, let me ask you, what federal court is it in?
It's probably in the I want to say it's probably in the U.S. Southern District, because, you know, it's that area around Bexar County is where the shooting took place, but I'll have to check it.
Oh, yeah, that would make sense. I was just curious.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. This is quite remarkable that this case is progressing the way that it is. And have there been any appeals to the Fifth Circuit to stop the case?
I don't think we're at that place yet. I could be wrong. I've kind of handed this story off to another reporter, so I'm not the lead on it anymore. But I don't believe that there's been an appeal to the Fifth Circuit yet, because we don't have any, you know, decision out of the first district court, U.S. district court yet. But I know that just, I guess, in late August, the attorneys filed a brief with the U.S. District Court that actually included information that they got from the government. So they've been able to get documents from the U.S. government. You know, these are documents we usually never see because it's so difficult to actually sue the government. But the document showed that the shooter had actually threatened people in the past. He threatened his superiors with violence. He'd even made statements that he would carry out some kind of mass violent act, and that his superiors at the Air Force were aware of this. And, you know, that added with the fact that he had a history of domestic violence and a history of being held in a mental health facility should have all, you know, kept him from being able to purchase a gun. But instead he just, you know, walked into a sporting goods store and purchased one because they neglected to report all of that to the NICS database. So it's pretty interesting evidence we're seeing that, you know, the families are arguing this could have been avoided, or it should have been a lot more difficult for this individual to get his hand on such, you know, on a firearm.
It seems like the bigger issue is what this might mean for Second Amendment and, you know, sale of guns just going in only one direction these days, even through the pandemic. Do you have any thoughts about that, about what this might mean for the larger question?
So I don't think that the lawsuit against the federal government necessarily will have any effect on how we currently enforce state and federal gun laws in the United States. But there's another lawsuit that's ongoing against the sporting goods store where the shooter bought his gun. And that lawsuit is interesting, I think, in terms of Second Amendment issues, because the families are also suing the sporting goods store, Academy Sports, saying that Academy is responsible because they sold a gun to the shooter that had a high capacity magazine, but the shooter presented a driver's license, an ID from Colorado, which is where his permanent residence was. And in Colorado, high capacity magazines are banned. So there's a question there about, and one of the key questions in that case is whether the Texas retailer had to enforce the gun law, the more restrictive gun laws from another state in making that sale. There's a lot of back and forth on that. So I think that would definitely, you know, raise questions about enforcing more restrictive gun laws in states like Texas from other states, maybe like California, Colorado, et cetera, that, you know, the lawmakers here have chosen to pass on. So I think that will be a really interesting test of Second Amendment issues. And, you know, that's still unanswered at this time, still going through the courts.
That is interesting. Interstate sales, essentially.
Right.
Let's move on a little. There's so much to choose from here. You were part of a team that wrote an article about QAnon back in early September. Could you tell us a little about that?
Sure. This was a rather unusual story. I mean, anything, I guess, involving QAnon seems unusual just from hearing. There was actually an assistant attorney general in our Texas office of the Texas Attorney General who was tweeting pretty outrageous things and was sharing his support for some QAnon beliefs, and also just tweeting threats, sometimes veiled, sometimes pretty overt threats against elected officials, most of them Democrats, you know, people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, even some threats against Joe Biden, veiled things, you know, like, I'm going to keep you in my crosshairs kind of language. And this man was working as, you know, a lawyer for the state of Texas, essentially. And none of us in the local media actually knew about his tweets and what he was doing. It was a left-leaning kind of media watchdog website that published the first story unveiling this, and then all of us followed. He was not trying to hide his posts, some of which were, you know, incredibly racist, some of which were homophobic. And he ended up basically being forced to leave the position. But for me and a lot of my colleagues in the Texas Press Corps, it kind of just heightened our sense of we need to be keeping a closer eye on some of the folks who are essentially representing the state of Texas, either in court or, you know, as elected officials. What exactly are they saying on a day-to-day basis? We have, I mean, thousands, literally thousands, maybe tens or hundreds of thousands of bureaucrats that work for state agencies. So it would be impossible to keep an eye on all of their Twitter handles. But, you know, this individual was going into the courtroom and acting as a lawyer on behalf of the state. And, you know, I commend the original report, the writers of the original report for finding this and showing that this person was very blatantly violating the agency's rules on social media, but also just making statements that were, you know, threatening potentially physical harm to people. And, you know, just saying things like he believes we're in the middle of another second war, a second civil war, you know, that transgender people are an abomination, you know, making no bones about his bigoted views. So it was a pretty incredible thing, pretty short-lived story since he was forced out so quickly. But yeah, interesting to know that there are QAnon conspiracy theory supporters in our own government, and some of them are not hiding their views at all. So we need to kind of keep an eye out for folks that might be undermining, you know, the respectability of the state if they're out there representing the state and saying these kinds of things publicly.
The scale of this whole thing is just what boggles my mind. I mean, fringe beliefs have been around for a long time, but, you know, as I pointed out in the introductory remarks, when you've got a reporter from Time Magazine interviewing dozens of people up in Wisconsin, and at the end of that, concluding that about 1 in 5 are really hooked on conspiracy theories, that gives you some sense about, you know, the magnitude of this.
Yeah. There's a great podcast if people kind of want to understand how people get hooked on these theories, and how we're living our lives, especially now during the pandemic, kind of contributes to that. It's called Rabbit Hole. The New York Times put it together, and it tracks one individual's descent into these conspiracy theory extremes of the internet very closely, into like actually the physical steps that he had to, the physical and mental steps he had to take to get there. And it was really fascinating for me because, you know, it kind of helps. It seems like such an outrageous thing, but like you said, more and more people are getting hooked on these ideas, or even just kind of keeping them a little bit at an arm's length, but thinking, you know, that makes some sense to me. And it kind of helped me understand how people make those leaps and jumps. And sometimes they're not really leaps. They're just a series of very small steps in that direction. And all of a sudden there they are, you know, on a website claiming that pedophiles are trying to take over the government. So I recommend it because it's a very, very well done look at, you know, how radically our lives have changed with things like YouTube and how that leads people into these dark corners of the internet.
You mentioned, for example, you know, civil war. You know, here we've got all these militias that seem to be totally out of control. You know, when last week we've got the Wolverine Warriors plotting to kidnap the governor of Michigan. What a wake-up call that was.
Right. And I mean, I think even, I mean, maybe not as scary, but equally as scary as, you know, that was part, like you said, of a broader plan that they had to spark some kind of civil war, or, you know, that was just the first step or one of many steps they were going to take towards that. So to think that, you know, that was happening without any of us in the public knowing is pretty shocking. It just makes you wonder where else it's happening. And sometimes it feels like it's kind of exhausting, right? It feels like we can't go a day without some new, like, horrific, shocking thing coming out. And it's good to be informed. And I love that, you know, we're getting more news than probably ever before in our country's history, but it's also, you know, it can be exhausting, and working in the business can be exhausting. It just feels like there's never enough bodies. There's never enough journalistic bodies to cover everything, let alone be able to dig down deeper into real accountability work. You know, we're kind of just trying to keep our heads above water is what it feels like right now sometimes.
Well, you know, Lauren, kudos to you and all the press. I mean, you're just doing a wonderful job, and particularly this era in America where the administration tries to discredit the press all the time. So thank you for all you do. And I was struck also by your comments right now that on this domestic terrorism, you know, is exactly where the FBI is in alerting us that this is the greatest threat right now inside our country. On the other hand, you have the administration, particularly Trump, trying to discredit the FBI director. And I find this to be really alarming instead of a sort of a cohesive understanding and approach to what's going on in the threat, that we end up in the administration trying to create disinformation and either greater discord, and the result of which in many respects is to actually increase the support of this domestic terrorism.
Well, you know, it feels almost like at the basis of all of these conversations, whether it's QAnon or, you know, the militia groups or, you know, everything really, Black Lives Matter, election balloting, the election, Medicare, healthcare. I mean, it almost feels like we have come to a place where we can't even agree on what the truth is, what is true and what is not true. There's like no light of day between at least the most extreme voices that are out there, which are, you know, unfortunately oftentimes the ones that get featured in the media. And it's kind of disheartening, right? Because it's, if we can't even agree, you know, what 1 + 1 equals, how are we going to agree on like how to solve the complex equations we need to keep our country running well? I think as a journalist that is particularly exhausting. The underlying assumptions that I think sometimes, you know, in the past we've been able to operate off of, this is true, this is not true, this is good, this is not good, have just fallen by the wayside. And every story, no matter how mundane it might seem, can become divisive and, you know, will elicit hate mail from whatever side feels like you didn't do a good enough job of representing their view. And that definitely has ticked up. I think it's great that, you know, we always want to hear from readers, but we can't make anyone happy, you know, no matter what we do. And, you know, the fact that we can't even agree on what, you know, the basic tenets are in terms of truth and righteousness and morality, it's makes it very difficult to feel like you're getting through to people or you're presenting information to people that helps inform them and helps them maybe think about how they live their daily lives or their belief system. It just feels, sometimes it feels like you're just screaming into a void, which is frustrating. But now it's just, I don't know, now I'm just complaining. So, you know, maybe we can move on to another topic.
Well, to weave another piece into this, you know, and I think this gels nicely. In the QAnon coverage, you were talking about a state employee. Let's focus on another state employee, one a little bit higher up in the ranks. Tell us a little about what's going on with Ken Paxton these days.
Oh boy, where do I start? Well, depending on when this airs, there may be even new information, but the most basic way to describe this is that several of Ken Paxton's most senior employees that work under him at the Office of the Attorney General have accused him of criminal acts. They say that he has some kind of friendship or relationship with a big time Austin real estate developer named Nate Paul. And they have accused Nate Paul of trying to use the office of the Attorney General to benefit him. Specifically, they've mentioned a number of times where Paxton has seemed to intervene on behalf of Nate Paul using the resources of the agency, like their opinions division, their ability to lodge investigations. And the senior employees say that that raises bribery and abuse of office concerns that they have forwarded to law enforcement. These are the most senior attorneys in the agency that basically just houses attorneys for the state of Texas. So these are, you know, seven individuals who came together to raise these concerns. They're very serious. They're criminal felony acts. And we don't know yet what is going to happen. Paxson hasn't been charged with anything, but there could be an investigation. We believe the investigation will probably take place within the FBI. The Texas Rangers say they are not investigating these claims, but that they forwarded the complaints they heard from the employees to federal investigators. The FBI won't confirm that they are looking into them because that's their policy, but that would probably be the entity that would investigate whether there is some kind of self-dealing or bribery happening between this real estate developer and our Texas Attorney General. The AG, from his perspective, says that Nate Paul raised concerns about an FBI raid that happened on Nate Paul's home and business last summer. He says these state and federal law enforcement agents violated his rights. He claims that they doctored search warrants and that he wants someone to investigate whether his rights were violated. So the attorney general took on that task, but his own employees said they looked into the allegations from Nate Paul and said that they didn't feel like they had any merit. So they recommended not going forward with an investigation. And then the attorney general himself went over their heads, hired an outside attorney to look into the allegations from Nate Paul, and they opposed the hiring of that outside attorney. It's a very complicated way of saying that these employees are saying that Ken Paxson is helping a friend and political donor go after some federal agents that raided his businesses and is using his office to do so. That's their allegation. Mm-hmm. We don't know where it's going to end up. And there's a lot more behind the story that I can't really reveal or talk about now that we're aware of, but we haven't been able to report. But it could get a whole lot messier before we see the end of this thing. And if listeners don't remember, our sitting attorney general is still under active indictment for securities fraud charges that date back to 2015. He's not gone to trial on those charges. They appear to be unrelated to these new allegations, but you know, he's just kind of always been under a legal cloud, and now that cloud appears to be getting bigger.
Wow. We're speaking with Lauren Magahi, an investigative reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Once again, thank you to all of our supporters. The fall membership drive has kept us on the air because of your generosity. In case you missed it, you can go to our website, koop.org, and click the donate button. Be assured of our gratitude to you, our partners, for 25 years of community radio for Austin. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's program was homecrafted and recorded on October 14th. We're speaking with Lauren Magahi, an investigative reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Let's continue. And even the governor has expressed some concerns, some reservations about this, no?
Yes, the governor and lieutenant governor have said it's concerning. When Paxson was indicted back in 2015, they did not express the same level of concern. So the fact that they're actually weighing in is significant. Congressman Chip Roy, a Republican who used to work for Paxson, has basically called on him to resign. Senator Cornyn, John Cornyn, who's also a Republican, gave a pretty scathing interview where he said, you know, he doesn't like how Paxson is running the office and that, you know, these allegations are very serious. They're coming from top employees who hold a lot of clout in the agency, and that he is also concerned about the allegations. And John Cornyn is a former attorney general, and so is Governor Abbott. And so the fact that they're weighing in and saying, you know, we need to take these allegations seriously is meaningful because they used to hold the office and because they're Republicans, fellow Republicans to Ken Paxson.
And, you know, some of this stuff is just so brazen, you know, that what he's doing, trying to get the, you know, the local state prosecutor or our county prosecutor, DA, to do something that involves federal law. I mean, it's so transparent that this is corrupt. And hiring this lackey, I'll call him that, young lawyer to do his bidding as a kind of a special prosecutor is just utterly bizarre. But what it reminds me of is this idea how political power corrupts when you're not prosecuted for it. You know, the fact that he skated along on this indictment for years, you know, creates this idea of invincibility. And we see this bizarre, crazy behavior happening. And thanks to those staff, those top staff that have called him on it. But you wonder how bad it was, you know, or what else goes on that doesn't arise to this level of corruption that we're seeing.
Well, and I won't, you know, I won't agree with anything you just said, you know, just because I'm covering this from, you know, an arm's length distance. He hasn't been convicted of anything. I think the biggest question right now on people's minds, however, is why would the top lawyer in the state go to bat for a real estate developer so hard? You know, he Ken Paxton has defended his actions a few times since this news broke, you know, just a couple of weeks ago. And he keeps defending it. I mean, he is doubling down very hard on the fact that he believes he was in the right. And the big question that is looming over all of this is why? We still don't know the exact nature of Ken Paxton's relationship with Nate Paul. He hasn't answered any of our questions about how they know each other, to what extent they know each other, how long, how they met. All we know about their connection publicly right now is that Nate Paul gave him $25,000 for in a campaign donation. But there's just so much mystery about why Paxton would go to bat for this guy so strongly and repeatedly when his own top employees are raising all of these questions. And he won't answer these most basic questions about why he would do that and how he knows Nate Paul. And I think that's just making people, you know, wonder what's the nexus of this whole thing? How did it get started? And it, like you said, is there more that we don't know that we still haven't figured out, not just related to Nate Paul, but potentially others, you know, inside the agency who Paxton has gone to bat for personally? So there's a lot of unanswered questions. Hopefully we'll answer some of them in the next week or so. I do think this is going to be a drawn out battle between these concerned employees and Ken Paxton.
Well, speaking of court cases, and I don't know if you've been covering this one in particular, but Jim, feel free to chime in. One that we've been particularly focused on this show has been the Abbott's executive order limiting counties to a single drop-off site for mail-in ballots. One of our colleagues here is actually working over there at 5501 Airport until Election Day, collecting the mail-in ballots. You know, we were waiting for a ruling, and Judge Robert Pittman indeed ruled last Friday night on that. And then immediately that went up to another court, which I believe stayed the executive order. So where's all that stand right now? I mean, I realize that they're still limited to a single site, but is this next court basically just going to drag its feet until November 3rd and that's the end of it?
No, they already ruled.
Did they?
Yep. No, I mean, this is reflective of the suppression, and this is a reflective of how important judges are. I mean, this may be, for me as a lawyer, of course, the most important thing the president does is appoint judges.
Yeah.
We see what that Fifth Circuit has done, you know, repeatedly to suppress the vote, you know, and these are done by Republican appointees, you know, and I think we just don't pay enough attention to the impact that these judges have in our lives when we're getting ready to decide for whom we're going to vote.
Jim, I have a question for you. I think it was yesterday the Fifth Circuit said Texas could offer just one drop-off location. Are the litigants going to ask for an en banc ruling, which is, you know, when they ask the full court, the full appeals court to look at that? Or do you know what happens next now?
So they have two options. They can ask for en banc. and or take it directly to the Supreme Court. I think both are dead ends. I mean, the Republicans on the Fifth Circuit in en banc outnumber the others. And the Supreme Court has been extraordinarily hostile to any of the cases that have been brought by plaintiffs, you know, regarding voting rights. So I don't see a lot of hope for it. And it's late in the game.
Right. If they did take it further, if they did ask for an en banc ruling or ask the Supreme Court to take it up, and the court didn't do so, either court didn't do so until after the election, would that apply in future, or is this really only to this election year?
It could apply in the future, depending on how the opinion is framed by the court, right? So, you know, what we did, we saw in Bush and Gore's Supreme Court case, was the Supreme Court carefully limited it to that single case and said it had no precedent for the future. So It really depends on how the court frames it. And I wouldn't be very optimistic at this point.
Well, and there's like a handful of other election related lawsuits, right, that are still also in court. If I wasn't working in the media, I would find it so confusing to know exactly when and where I can vote and, you know, what my options are. Do you have suggestions for folks that want straightforward information about how to vote and when to vote, how to make sure they're registered, all that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think in particularly people in this county, Travis County, they're really good website up right now about answering exactly those questions. What happens if you've received an absentee ballot? Can you still go in person? Answer is yes. Take the ballot with you and surrender it. Where can you vote? The fact that you can vote in any polling place throughout the county, you don't have to go to your precinct. Great list of where everything is, English and Spanish. So if you're in Travis County, you're really in good shape. Just go to the website, and it has really, really good information, not only particular or specific to Travis County, but answering these general questions that you're raising. And I think this is true in my understanding as well, as Harris County is really bending over backwards to accommodate people. And then I noticed that both CNN and ABC websites have nationwide voting rights sites that you can plug into, and you give your zip code and it focuses you on what you need to know about your state or your area. So there are resources out there, I think, that are actually pretty good trying to deal with what's going on in this suppression of the vote that people can look at. The greater problem for me, And I think this is what you're articulating, is what happens further down our social structure, where you have people that don't have the kind of internet facility skills or use that we have, and also are very often intimidated by this stuff that's put out by the opposition that scares people off from voting. I mean, we've had a discussion with other folks on the same program about that issue, right?
Yeah.
But I also see there's a lot of push back going on to encourage people to get out there and vote. But I've never seen an attack on voting like we've seen this year. I mean, this is absolutely incredible. Instead of the president trying to make sure we have a smooth election, doing everything that he can, calling out, as he says, his troops to be on guard during this election, it's just awful. It's crazy, but it's dangerous to our republic.
Well, it's been a pretty crazy year all around. Back to some of your reporting, Lauren, various stories about the pandemic, about budget cuts for health and food assistance, release of prisoners postponed, alcohol and opioid use increasing. Do you want to touch on any of those?
Sure. I've been trying to keep a close eye, and frankly, I've been distracted by the Ken Paxton news that's broken in the last couple of weeks, but I've been trying to keep a close eye on the situation of COVID in the prison system here. We still have hundreds of thousands of people incarcerated in Texas, and there were some pretty bad outbreaks in some of these facilities, and more than 150, I believe, inmates died due to COVID. And those are just the ones that, you know, the prison system determined were COVID deaths. So there's probably many more that were unclear, but you know, COVID contributed to those deaths. And there was a number of staff, prison staff, who died as well. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of communities that are hit hard, that have been hit hard, especially hard by COVID. But the prison community is one that is oftentimes forgotten. And I've been trying to at least semi-regularly put out the information about those deaths, even if I'm just tweeting new ones. And, you know, something that I hope to write about soon, and, you know, hopefully I'm not giving this scoop to someone else who's listening to the show, is that prison staff, especially correctional workers, are having trouble getting their workers' comp filings approved for COVID-related illnesses, frankly, because the state says that correctional officers cannot prove that they got COVID on the job. And this is something that is really frustrating the union that represents the correctional officers, who believe that, you know, they need the extra help that you get from workers' comp to pay for medical bills or other, you know, bills that might have, you know, ratcheted up if they had to take time off of work because they were sick. And, you know, at one point, a couple of weeks ago, we had more correctional officers and TDCJ employees who were infected with the virus than we had inmates. The numbers were actually flipped. And so the virus has affected not just inmates, but the staff that are tasked with watching them in the prisons. And I think that's something that it's just a community that, you know, there's a handful of really great journalists keeping an eye on it, but, you know, there's never enough. And just reiterating to folks to, you know, to remember that there's a lot of closed communities like this, you know, prisons, nursing homes that have been especially hard hit by the virus. They deserve to have their stories told as well.
You mentioned great journalists covering this. We've had Michael Barajas on here a couple times this year addressing that very issue. And we've also had earlier in the year, Amanda Wu talked about the state dragging its feet on releasing people from jail just at the outbreak of the pandemic. So,
yeah. And, you know, we have, the state had an opportunity to make some changes in terms of how it wanted to release folks during the pandemic from prisons and jails. And, you know, at every turn, those changes were stymied. And there, people have died because of it. There's at least, looking at this spreadsheet that I've put together, there's at least 8 men who were approved for parole, which means that they were supposed to be released, you know, within several months or days, that died of COVID instead of being released. And it's cases like that, that, you know, just, they raise questions about, you know, what is it about our system that led to the unnecessary death of these people? And keeping more people inside the prisons exacerbates the spread. So even if you want to say, well, you know, those folks are still on the inside, you know, they need to serve the time for the crime, keeping more bodies inside the prison increases the spread, not just between inmates, but also to staff. And then staff go out and they spread it in the community to their families. And so, it, you know, this is a community safety problem question. It's one that we didn't see any movement on at all. No changes, at least at the prison level, in terms of how they were taking the virus into account in terms of releasing people. And I think that's been kind of surprising to me that there's just been no movement on that at all. And as a consequence, we've actually seen people die in prison who should have been released.
Thinking about what's going on as we speak here, either one of you have any thoughts about what's going on with the Supreme Court?
Jim, it's all you.
Well, I'm not drinking hemlock yet, but I have it sitting on my desk. I'm really struck about how politicized the court has become as a political football. It's not to say the court wasn't politicized in the past, for sure, but I think the extent of it, to me, is just quite astonishing at this point. And the ideological ideas that Republicans are trying to oppose, I think, are quite alarming in the sense that their agenda is really to sort of undo a lot of decisions that have been made, which in the law is really is sort of anathema to the idea of building respect for the law, that there's consistency and constancy. Again, not that decisions don't get overturned, but they don't get overturned in the sense that we see the move right now is basically to overturn anything in recent times that the conservatives don't agree with. So I'm not very optimistic about how long it's going to take to undo the damage that has been done and restore sort of in some respect to the court. I imagine Roberts prides himself on his place in history is really quite distressed with the politicization of the court that's gone on. But boy, I tell you, as a civil rights lawyer, I mean, I really feel for those people that are doing civil rights right now, because man, it's the cards are stacked from the Supreme Court all the way down to the district court.
You know, in all this, the name Merrick Garland is like a banner over my thoughts, and I can't listen to the hearings. I just see red. We're about out of time here. Many, many thanks for joining us, Lauren. You're working on some great stories there. And to echo what Jim said earlier, keep up the good work.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on and for digging deep into some of these issues that I feel like we're just only scratching the surface. So thanks for keeping an open discussion about them. I appreciate it.
Keep up the good work. We're behind you. We need you, actually. We need you badly.
Good luck.
Thanks.
I'm going to get some ice cubes from my hemlock.
All right.
We'll see y'all later.
It's Friday afternoon, October 16th. We've got a few minutes left here. And our buddy Austin Sanders is back with us again. Austin is a staff writer at the Austin Chronicle. How you doing, Austin?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me again, Bob.
City Council meeting yesterday. What's going on there?
Yeah, so they met. So 2 weeks ago, they approved $15 million in this fund that's intended to help childcare centers, live music venues, and then kind of like bars and restaurants. They each will get like $5 million to help. And staff initially thought that the money should be used to help like pay the rent and other immediate needs. But council kind of said, we want this money to be used for long-term sustainability. So Mayor Adler pushed staff to find ways of pairing businesses with attorneys or accountants to kind of help strategize on ways to really survive through the pandemic and then beyond it. Music venues were already struggling before the pandemic. So this is really how they're kind of envisioning using that $15 million fund. So staff is working on that, and hopefully it'll provide some relief to some of these struggling businesses in the near future.
Thanks for the update on that. I understand you wrote a story providing an update on the Michael Ramos case. What's going on there?
Yeah, so we're coming up on 6 months since Michael Ramos was killed by an APD officer, Christopher Taylor, in Southeast Austin. It was on April 24th. He was killed while he was unarmed and fleeing slowly in his vehicle. And what we learned last week is that the Austin Police Department portion of the criminal investigation is completed. So basically, anytime a police officer, you know, is accused of committing a crime or allegedly commit a crime, APD has this team of detectives called the Special Investigations Unit that looks into the criminal side of the matter. And then that evidence that they collect is handed over to the district attorney's office to either, you know, present a case to a grand jury to see if the officer should be indicted for whatever crime they allegedly committed, or the DA can reject the case to say that there isn't a case here. There's also, you know, concurrently with the Special Investigations Unit, a internal affairs investigation, which is looking at whether or not the officer in question committed a policy violation. Now, APD tells us that the internal affairs investigation is ongoing, but several weeks ago is what we've learned. We're not totally sure when the SIU investigation completed, but they're finished with that part, and they're kind of waiting. An APD spokesperson told us the Texas Rangers, who were brought in to help with this investigation, They're finalizing some documentation, and then the Travis County medical examiner is kind of doing the same thing. So that piece of it, at least for APD, has been completed.
Interesting. Any speculation about how the rest of this is going to unfold? How much time will be needed?
Right. Well, that's the other frustration for advocates, and especially Brenda Ramos. That's Michael's mother. She lost her only son in this tragic incident. Ever since that happened, we've seen the video. There was people at the scene who recorded on their cell phone. So we've known since then what transpired. And ever since, Brenda has been calling for the officer to be disciplined, charged with the crime, and arrested. None of those things have happened at this point. And that's partly because earlier this year, District Attorney Margaret Moore, who lost her primary race to Jose Garza, who's likely to win in November to be Travis County's next district attorney, Margaret Moore announced that she is not going to present this case to a grand jury, even though she decided at the end of May, May 29th, I think, she announced publicly that she intended to present the case to the grand jury. Later, she said after she lost her primary, she's not doing that anymore because, I'm kind of paraphrasing, but the people have spoken by electing Jose Garza as the Democratic nominee, and the next district attorney should be the one to present these cases to the grand jury. So what that means for Brenda Ramos and anyone else interested in this case is it won't be presented to the grand jury until January 2021 at the earliest. And that's very optimistic because you have to account for a transition period. You know, Jose Garza will take, or whoever is elected the next DA, most likely to be Jose, he'll take office in January, but he's got to kind of get up to speed. You know, he's got to figure out what cases are waiting for him. He knows these are there, but there's certainly will be other cases waiting for his office to prosecute. So it's really much more likely that the case would not be presented to a grand jury until later into 2021.
Well, when I first heard that news about, you know, Margaret Moore deciding she wasn't going to do any more on this, it just sounded like so much sour grapes, you know?
Yeah, it's been a puzzling choice for a lot of people and advocates and really frustrating. And what's kind of, you know, making it even more frustrating is Chief Brian Manley, who has the sole authority to discipline either of the officers, Christopher Taylor or Mitchell Piper. Piper is the one who fired the non-lethal round at Michael Ramos, and then Taylor fired the lethal shots. Both of them are under internal investigation for their actions and could be disciplined based on those investigations. And only Chief Manley can issue that discipline. But he has said that he's not going to do that, if it's warranted, until the criminal process concludes. And he said that that was because Margaret Moore asked him to hold off on doing that. And she had her reasons for making that request. Jose Garza, again, most likely to be the next DA, has said, you know, basically, Chief, don't let me stop you. If you think that these officers are a threat to the community or they violated APD policy, then by all means, they should be punished. But through a spokesperson, Chief Manley said that he still stands by that position, that he does not intend to issue any disciplinary action until the criminal process concludes, which itself is a question. Does that mean if the grand jury decides to indict Officer Taylor, is that a conclusion of the criminal process? Or is it after a verdict is delivered at a trial, which again could be months, even a year from now?
So there's so many contingencies here, and this one's waiting for that one, and sequencing and whatnot. I mean, this sounds like it could potentially drag out for months yet.
Right, right. And I think you have to really, you know, think about Brenda Ramos, the mother, in this situation. You know, she is experiencing this grief and really in limbo, really desperate for accountability for what happened to her son, justice for what happened to her son. And so much of it is out of her control. And our top law enforcement officials are both, you know, just not really acting. There are things they could do to help achieve accountability and justice, but they're not acting. And so I think it's a really difficult situation for Brenda to be in.
Well, we appreciate your staying on top of this, Austin. It served as a rather tragic introduction to a very tragic summer. I think everyone would love to see this drawn to a conclusion quickly. not the least of whom is Brenda Ramos. Thank you so much for your update here. We're about out of time, and we'll be back in touch.
Hi, this is Melinda B. from the Africa Express, and you know, elections aren't just about the candidates. They're really about you. Want to have a say in what happens to your country and your state, your community, or your future? You have a personal stake in the upcoming elections. Learn the issues at vote411.org and cast your vote early in Texas from October 15th through the 30th or on Election Day, November 3rd. Your vote is your voice.
Well, that's all for this evening. Take care, everyone. Stay safe.